On the Commons is a weekly radio show dedicated to discussing the many issues surrounding mandatory common ownership development. It is broadcast live from WEBR Fairfax, Virginia. Join us as we explore the world of common ownership development, the fastest growing form of residential development in America today. This housing concept includes condominiums, cooperatives, and both attached and detached single-family homes that are part of a mandatory homeowners association. Unfortunately, this type of housing is not as utopian as its advocates would have us believe. Living in a mandatory homeowners association means giving up part of the American dream. It means giving up constitutional rights and control over one's most valuable asset, one's home. Living in a mandatory homeowners association means leaving the American zone. WEBR Fairfax Radio, welcome to On the Commons. I'm Sue Bartholomew. And On the Commons with me today is an old friend of the show's and an old friend of homeowners across the country, Professor Evan McKenzie. Evan, thanks so much for joining us today.
Oh, thank you for having me on, Sue. It's good to talk with you.
It's good having you here. But before we get started, we've got a full program. I just want to let you know that the Pink Flamingo struck again this morning.
Oh, my goodness.
Shortly before leaving for the station, I received a box full of Pink Flamingos. Anything that's Pink Flamingo, totes, pens, pins, wall hangings, bric-a-bracs, magnets, keychains, picture frames, just a whole lot of little water globes. Anyway, Pink Power lives on. Thank you to the Pink Phantom, and you know who you are. So I've got a room full of Pink Flamingos now, and I've just added a whole lot to them.
You can start a museum now.
I'm almost at that point, but it's a lot of fun. Thank you so much for joining us, Evan.
My pleasure.
You're always a very busy person. You've been particularly busy just lately. I know you've been on travel, and you're going to tell us what you've been doing. But can we start with the Twin Rivers case that you were an expert witness in?
Yes, that's right. A lot of your listeners probably know, but the Twin Rivers case is a case brought in the state courts of New Jersey concerning... It's ultimately brought by the American Civil Liberties Union, and particularly Frank Askin, who you've had on your show, I believe.
Yes, he did come out.
Of the Constitutional Litigation Clinic at Rutgers Law School. And it's an attempt to convince the state courts in New Jersey that homeowner associations in some situations, like Twin Rivers, for example, being a gigantic city-like homeowner association that has public streets and public facilities inside it, is really the functional equivalent of a city, of a municipality, and therefore they should have to respect some of the basic rights of citizenship under the New Jersey State Constitution. And so the case has come on for summary judgment. There really are no disputed factual issues. It's a legal dispute, and so we've just had the ruling from the trial court judge on the summary judgment case, and now we will be going up on appeal. And it's very likely, I think, personally, that it will end up in the New Jersey Supreme Court and that they will make the final call on this.
And any predictions on what their decision will be?
Well, I believe that we should prevail. There are nine causes of action total. One of them has already been resolved, which had to do with in our favor, which had to do with the right to tape record open meetings of the Twin Rivers Homeowners Association. We've already basically won that by the defendants conceding on that point. So there are eight remaining causes of action, and I believe that on at least six or seven of these, we should eventually prevail. That's my view, but in the trial court, we prevailed on three of the remaining eight, and the defendants prevailed on five. So if you want, I can go through and tell you what they are.
Well, it's up to you, I think, if you want to do that. So basically I understand that the association, Twin Rivers, is not particularly happy that the homeowners will be appealing.
Well, yeah, I read that somewhere.
Yeah.
The president of the association thinks they should just go away. But that's been sort of the attitude that the association has displayed toward the plaintiffs in this case for quite some time. I mean, really, that's what the whole case is about, is really the internal political processes of Twin Rivers, where you see a whole series of quite authoritarian practices that make it very difficult for the members of Twin Rivers to successfully challenge the current leadership. That's really what it's about. It's ultimately, in my view, it's ultimately about the ability of homeowner association residents to really actually have a functioning local democracy, which is what everyone says they're supposed to have. But when you have, when you're denied access to the community room, when you're denied access to the financial documents, when you're denied access to the voting lists, you can't even use alternative dispute resolution because the association, it defines it in such a way that it doesn't cover any violations of the rules by the directors or members. The local Twin Rivers newsletter is just an organ to trumpet the views of the board president and so forth. And when members of the Committee for a Better Twin Rivers are basically denied the ability to vote or run for office by being cited for trivial violations and other bogus things, you know, you don't really have a functioning democracy.
Yeah, how does that happen?
That's all we're really trying to accomplish here.
How does that happen? I mean, you know, I can understand if you're not paid up, and even then I'll concede that one. But when the board and the management company has the power to basically sort of send you a violation notice, whether or not there's any real violation there or not, but then deny you your voting rights and deny you the right to run for office, you know,
right. It's just...
It doesn't take much imagination to understand how lopsided this whole thing is.
Well, I think that's the whole problem, you know, really, that it's the basic problem with homeowner association governance, in my view, is not that the directors are awful people or that the lawyers are bad people or any of this. It's not that. The problem is you don't have any protection if they are. Because this is a...
It's true.
There's a lot of human diversity. Some people are great people, some people are not.
That's right.
In ordinary municipal governance, you have protections against abuses. And in homeowner association governance, you don't. And that's the problem, that we have to put, there have to be protections against abuse. Because if you do get people who don't want to let you compete fairly in elections, and you don't have anywhere to turn, you don't have any government agency to turn to, and your only recourse is to get a lawyer and spend $50,000 in legal fees, that's not a very good system, in my view.
Now, I agree with you, and not everybody has the money, and, you know, $50,000 these days seems to be on the low end. I mean, we're hearing of people spending hundreds and hundreds of thousands, you know.
Coming, absolutely.
Even coming close to $1 million, which is ridiculous. And at that point, you know, at what point do you say, wait a minute, the house isn't worth it anymore?
That's what almost everybody says. Almost all people who would like to challenge these sorts of practices end up saying, well, it's not worth it to go fight it out alone. And that's the whole problem. So, because for an individual, usually it is not worth it alone. You need to, and this is really where, to me, government has kind of abdicated its responsibility, because the government is supposed to look out for these sort of market failure situations, the kinds of situations where contract relationships really don't solve all the problems. Like, for example, in the case of air pollution, if water pollution, this sort of thing, individual polluters have an incentive, an economic incentive, that makes pollution profitable for them. So they will dump the costs of their pollution in terms of bad water and bad air on everybody generally. And there's really no one individual for whom it is worth fighting City Hall and trying to redress all that. And that's where government has to step in and say, wait a minute, even though it's in your interest to do these things, we're going to change the incentive so it's not worth your while to do this anymore, through penalties, regulations, et cetera. And it's market failure situations like that where the water is getting poisoned for all of us, so to speak, that government ought to step in. And that's what's happening, I think, with homeowner associations. We have a collective problem here. And it shouldn't be on the burden of one individual to try to solve it.
But the mandates that we run into across the country basically are responsible, I think, for the proliferation of associations. And
what,
you and
are
I.
Are you fading out? Your voice is fading out there, Sheila.
I'm sorry. I said the mandates that we're finding throughout the country, local municipal mandates, I think, are responsible for the proliferation of homeowners associations. They then take a hands-off approach to the whole problem and say, hey, wait a minute. We're just not going to get involved. It's your problem. You take care of it.
Yeah, I agree. I mean, I think that it's really a kind of a, I don't know, maybe shameful is too strong a word, or maybe it's not, but the attitude that local governments are taking, this sort of hands-off attitude, we're not responsible for any of the problems where homeowner associations are involved, is really, I think, indefensible. They are the ones who are responsible for permitting this type of thing to happen, and as has been proven many times in a number of areas, parts of the country, they're not only permitting it, they're mandating it.
Yeah, they are. They're mandating.
How can they stand back, mandate this type of construction for their own economic interest because of the double taxation issue? They make huge profits. They use the homeowner associations and their residents as cash cows. And then they act like, well, any problems that arise, are those are private problems. Those are individual problems between you, Mr. Homeowner, and you, your association. Well, that's the whole issue right there. You've got hundreds of thousands of people in a given metropolitan area like Las Vegas or Henderson or Mesa or Phoenix, any number of Hilton Head. So, you could just go on and on with these places where there's nothing else to buy, Irvine. And then the governments stand back and just put their hands in their pockets and say, oh, well, if you have a problem, we'll take it up with the state courts or, you know, go hire a lawyer.
You agreed.
Take it to the state legislature. Change the entire law of the entire state of California if you have a problem. I mean, what is this? They're the ones who are putting this situation, bringing this into existence.
Yeah, not only that, but in Fairfax County, where about 90% of all housing is in an association, the other 10% is rapidly disappearing because not only are they building more and more where there was nothing before, but they're tearing down existing developments, older developments, and replacing them with stacked and packed attached housing. And they mandate associations.
Right.
And they have, in at taxpayers' expense, someone in the Consumer Protections, the Consumer Affairs Department, and this guy is a liaison, an official liaison to the industry. If a homeowner goes to him, the homeowner is told, we're sorry, you're not the client, the association's the client.
Right. Yeah, you see, again and again you see the same problem, where the individual owners are just non-existent from the standpoint of these local authorities. They're supposed to be protected only by their contractual rights and powers, which they cannot enforce except through retaining a lawyer that they can't afford. In the meantime, they're paying for the association's lawyer through their assessments. You know, and look, the fact is that government officials do understand this situation. They do know this is happening. But no one has been able to make them do anything about it. And what really distresses me, I know there's different perspectives on this, but what really distresses me is that homeowner activists, as far as I can see, have given local government a complete pass as a focus of activism. They are constantly ranting and raving about the abuses of lawyers and CAI and on and on. And here are the local governments that are essentially, you know, throwing people in the river, you know.
And especially the Twin Rivers.
Trying to haul them out. But what about the people who are throwing them in the river? You know, it's the municipalities and the counties that are permitting this stuff. And really, it needs to be addressed at that level, I think. Somehow, because they really control land use policy. You know, land use policy is generally set at the state level, true, and it's influenced by the federal level, undoubtedly. But the decisions to permit or deny the right to construct are made at the county and the city level. And I really believe that if there's going to be any housing choice preserved in the market, somebody's got to put some pressure on these municipalities and counties to maintain choice in new housing so that people can opt in or out. Because as you say, not only is it in the new condo construction, the new townhouse construction, the new PUD construction, that's everywhere. That's the lion's share of new construction. And that's the lion's share of new construction in redeveloped areas, like around the city of Chicago, for example, and every major city where there's a lot of redevelopment. It's all done in privatized developments. Then, increasingly, they're trying to either knock down existing houses and rebuild them as PUDs of some sort, or privatizing existing neighborhoods.
Where they
don't have an association, they don't have a mandatory association, but they have interlocking covenants. So they set up some sort of election and privatize the neighborhood, make it into a mandatory dues-paying association. I mean, most of these decisions are actually happening at the local level, I think.
We're hearing more and more of that. In fact, I just got an email today from someone saying, my neighbors want to impose an association. I bought a place specifically because it was not in an association. Can they do that to me? And I'm hearing more of that all the time.
It does happen. The Colorado Supreme Court allowed exactly that to happen in the past year. With 60%, a vote of 60% of the subdivision owners.
But they're taking
a dues-paying association for everybody.
But they're taking away a right that you bought when you bought your house. I mean, it's a taking. And that's kind of what, you know, last week I had the mayor of Gilbert on, Steve Berman.
Uh-huh.
And he was talking about takings, that, you know, when you sort of deny people the right to use their property the way they want to use it, they come back and they say, all right, that constitutes a taking. You buy it from me at fair market value. And he says the city's ending up with all of this. Now, Gilbert does have mandates, and he came on the show last week, and he said if they cannot fix the problems with the abuses in associations, he says, I'm going to stop allowing them to be built here.
Well, I suppose where we have to go with this, right? I mean, either the problems have to be fixed, or else there has to be some kind of moratorium or something. That's probably the wrong word for it. But you can't just keep on reproducing more and more of these problems, because the problems are headed straight into the court system, for one thing. And then it goes into the legislature, and then it goes into the press. And ultimately, this is all bad for the housing market. This is all bad for housing prices in a given area. And I think politicians may be starting to recognize that. They say, well, gee, you know, wait a minute. If the public opinion sort of gels in the posture that Mesa or Gilbert or Phoenix or Las Vegas is a dangerous place to buy a new house because of association abuses, I can see where an intelligent public official would say, we better do something about this. So maybe it'll be that kind of leverage in the publicity and so forth that goes with it that will make a difference.
I don't know. I think, you know, I get a little frustrated sometimes with a lot of the horror stories, but I think that they're necessary to just point out that there is a problem.
Yes, because, you know, I listed about 20 in the first chapter of my book on this topic, and then the first thing I heard when I was doing radio interviews and stuff was, well, that's only 20 isolated cases.
Yeah.
Oh, fine. Well, I could have listed more, so how many should we list? How many is enough? I guess you just have to keep them going.
Well, you know? I have 3,000 of them sitting on my hard drive, 3,000 articles. So, you know, 3,000 isolated incidents.
Yeah, that's right. 3,000. Well, that's just 3,000. You need it.
Yeah, and there's 50 million of people out there. You know? So it's just a drop in the bucket. It's really not a problem. You see, not everybody was having a problem.
Well, no, it's true. And I freely acknowledge that most associations, the majority of associations, most of the time, are running. In, the people are trying to operate them in good faith. Most of the time, that's the norm. You know, I don't know what percentage it is, but I think more often than not, most association directors are simply trying to do their job. They're not a bunch of tyrants and so forth. However, the percentage of abuses is high enough that it's a serious problem, especially when you figure there's really no corrective mechanism. That's the key problem. Yes, most of the time they operate fine, but they don't operate fine either through bad faith or incompetence a significant percentage of the time. And when they do go wrong, there's no easy recourse. There's no counterweight or no checking mechanism except to go do something you can't afford to do, which is file a lawsuit. That's the problem. And that is a bad situation, and it's untenable. It's in the long run, it's not a sustainable situation. This something has to give.
Let me ask you something, Evan. How much influence or how much does... Do decisions like...
How much does what have?
I'm sorry, I just knocked something off. How much does the decisions like Judge Schuster's have in terms of you know, in contributing towards the problems in associations. I mean, his report was just terrible. His opinion was incredibly bad.
Yeah, I think that I've read the opinion pretty carefully. I think it's really kind of it's very weak, and it does not come to grips with the big picture at all. He simply takes each individual count and looks at it in a very legalistic way and really fails to come to grips with the big picture, which is the denial of basic political rights within the association to these people. He just goes one item at a time, and then he looks at the little statutes and doesn't say, he says, well, maybe it's a contract of adhesion, but it's not unconscionable and blah, blah, blah. You know, it's really, he just fails to address the big picture. And
Does he see it?
Particularly on ADR. You know, you've got a provision on ADR here in this, in these association documents. The New Jersey law requires that there be ADR procedures. And the association, the Twin Rivers Association, adopted this just ridiculous policy that says that the disputes that are subject to ADR shall not include issues relating to the payment of assessments, election issues, or compliance or non-compliance with the governing documents by members of the board.
What's left?
What?
What's left?
Yeah, what's left? You know, I said this at the CAI meeting. I read this to a whole group of CAI lawyers, and I read this off, and the room erupted in laughter, and several people said, so what else is there?
Yeah.
What else would you want to do? I mean, it's completely ridiculous. So essentially, you really can't get any recourse against the board for any significant matters using ADR. Well, you know, if they're going to approach, if a judge can ratify something like that and say, well, technically that's still all right under the law, really then that says the courts are not there for you either.
No, they're
not.
You
turn to the owners and you say, your remedies lie in contract. And so here they've got a lawsuit, and the owners go right ahead and they say, all right, fine, let's vindicate our rights, let's go to court. And the judge says, well, even here in court, even asserting your contractual rights, all the rights that you have as a citizen, there's nothing for you here. You're just subject to all this abuse. That simply is a complete misunderstanding of what needs to be done here, because this is not a fair situation. The situation at Twin Rivers is abusive. It is abusive. And anyone with an ounce of common sense can see it. So I just feel that he's way off on this, and it's a big, it's a failure, really, of the courts, of this court, to really address the problems. Now we have to go to another court.
We're talking to Professor Evan McKenzie. He's the author of Privatopia. And that kind of leads us, Evan, to rights and responsibilities, doesn't it?
Yes.
Okay. Rights and responsibilities is a new, what would you call it, a program?
Well, it's a descendant of the original, I think it was 1985 or thereabouts, when CAI first came out with a thing called the Homeowners Bill of Rights. They started advocating that homeowners in associations should have a Bill of Rights. So that it would be kind of like what a simple, plain language understanding of the rights of people living in associations. And that has now been replaced by Rights and Responsibilities for Better Communities, which is a new document that was written by, the project was, I think, largely supervised by Molly Foley Healy of the national staff at CAI, and a number of other people had input into it, including Dave Ramsey from New Jersey and a whole bunch of other people. And it's an attempt by CAI to create a document that they could get adopted, that associations would adopt, and that would give them a plain language understanding, and sort of a social contract, you might say, that of the relationship between owners and what they call community leaders, by which they mean the boards. So it's got a whole list of rights and responsibilities of rights of owners, responsibilities of owners, rights of community leaders, responsibilities of community leaders. And so that is the document there. And it is not completely clear yet how the document is going to be used, but I know they are going to try to get such things as, for example, if an association were to formally adopt rights and responsibilities, there would be some incentives, such as maybe they would get a reduced insurance rate if you could persuade insurance companies, you know, that if they adopt this, there might be less litigation, so then maybe they should have lower insurance rates. Maybe it would be a seal of approval of some sort that realtors would be aware of, to, so that if owners are afraid of high levels of conflict in associations, they could say, well, this one is a rights and responsibilities community and might have less, that sort of thing. And it would be a way of addressing a lot of the bad press, and also of convincing legislators that it is not necessary to go ahead with sort of draconian legislation that micro-regulates the associations.
But, you know, I had, we talked about it. I covered this last year when it first came out, and I had Pia Trigiani in the studio with me, and we talked about rights and responsibilities. And she went through the whole hour, and we talked about the individual rights and responsibilities that are enumerated here. And when we came to the end of the show, I said, so how do you intend to enforce this?
Yep.
And she said, she looked at me and she said, shoo, she says, you're so enforcement. She's enforce. She says, we're not going to enforce this. She says, this is nothing but aspirations.
Right.
So, you know, we aspire to be, what, good citizens? And then, you know, they're going to get a certificate from CAI and people are supposed to buy in. I mean, do we know that people are going to adhere to any of this stuff just because they say they do, and that one board decides that they're going to adopt rights and responsibilities for better communities, and we all know that you're only one election away from having everything turned around. Do we know that the next board coming along, I mean, if I were CAI, I'd feel very uncomfortable doing something like that.
You know, those are all good points. I have a couple of perspectives on this. One is, first of all, enforcement. When you use the term enforcement, what we're talking about here ultimately is law. And we already have issues of what kind of regulation should emanate from the state level and so forth in all the various states. So this is not part of that debate.
Okay, no, this is...
We already have regulation. We already have thou shalt do this and thou shalt not do that.
Right.
What we don't have, as I keep pointing out, you know, is any real government personnel in most states for anyone to talk to complain about it. But the point is, there are already all these micro regulations in effect. Now, what we're talking about here is something to keep it from going to that level. This is something that would be a philosophical document. It's not supposed to be enforced because that's what law is for. This is not law.
Okay.
This is about changing people's mindset to try to create a common understanding of where they are. Because a lot of the problems, and this has come out again and again, I mean, Barton and Silverman and everybody has found the same thing from the 80s on. The problem is, that, among other things, a complete misunderstanding of how this is all supposed to work philosophically. I mean, many owners come in and act like, do this, my home is my castle routine. You know, I'm sorry, but, you know, I have no sympathy for that. I have absolutely no sympathy for that, unless you're in one of these areas where you can't buy anything else. I mean, you people have to be held accountable for knowing that you are buying in common interest housing. And if you do it and you go in, you should not be going in there and saying, okay, now I'm going to paint my house pink because I want to. I mean, don't buy in it if you don't want to do that, you know? And that's one thing they're trying to do, is to get people to accept the basic concept, or don't buy it.
Okay.
Don't go in.
Okay.
And then you've got these directors who think that they can do whatever they want. This happens a lot. You know, directors who think that, well, I have a position of power, now I can order around everybody in the neighborhood. Well, that's another thing that they've got to understand they can't do. So the point of this document, I guess, as I understand it, is to get people on the same page, to get the directors and the owners on the same page philosophically, to sort of fill the gap between the covenants and state law in plain language, like a simple insurance policy does, you know, these plain language insurance policies. They just say, look, here's the way this is supposed to work. Now, everybody read it and understand it. Now, maybe this will have no effect. I don't know. I think there's going to be a lot of conflict in associations no matter what they do. Because they're sucking in large numbers of people who don't know anything about this type of living and didn't really choose it. That's the biggest problem, is the number of people who come into it just because there's nothing else in the market.
I guess, you know? my use of the word enforcement was not a good word. The point, my question, though, is CAI gives you a certificate if you say that you're going to adopt rights and responsibilities. they'll give you a certificate. Now, the association can use this as a marketing tool. I move to Chicago or Mesa or anywhere else. There's nothing out there that's not in an association. I have to buy a house. So I say to my realtor, all right, well, I want a rights and responsibilities community because yep. I know that they're going to be, you know, I know that they're going to be a little more human than the other ones.
Right.
How does CAI know that having given these people a certificate, that the next board coming along is not going to blow it off?
Right. And we, at the panel that I attended, this general issue was discussed. Okay, what does this actually mean? How does this actually work? And my suggestion was that this is not going to work at all unless it binds professionals. Because the board members are heavily dependent, as we all know, on lawyers and property managers. And the people, this is a two-way document. It basically speaks from professionals to the directors and the owners.
That's right.
And my view is, it's got to speak, this document has got to be a three-way document that binds three parties, the professionals, the directors, and the owners together with one understanding. You can't leave the professionals out of this document. It's got to be an agreement that binds the professionals. And so they sign on to the same document. You know, let's have rights and responsibilities professionals, too. If we're going to have rights and responsibilities communities and owners, let's have some rights and responsibilities lawyers. And this kind of dovetailed with what Wayne Hyatt had to say. Wayne Hyatt is sort of the dean of community association lawyers. And he proposed at the conference that there should be standards of professional conduct, not punitive ethical standards, because that's what the Bar Association does, you know. Not legal ethics, something more detailed, something more specific to what we're doing than that. That community association lawyers should develop real guidelines or standards of professional conduct and professionalize the way they behave and stop engaging in abusive practices that are destructive to this entire housing sector and that cast these community association lawyers in bad repute. And he's not alone, Shu. There are a lot of lawyers who spoke out publicly at this meeting saying that they are concerned about these issues and they would support such a thing. Now, there are some lawyers who spoke out and said, I don't care, I'll do whatever I want. I heard some really shocking comments from a couple of these people.
Oh, really?
Oh, yes. Oh, yes, really shocking comments saying, basically, look, on the subject of foreclosure, a big part of this conference was about foreclosure abuses. And there were lawyers there who spoke out and said, look, I wouldn't... Well, Wayne Hyatt, he said he thinks that nonjudicial foreclosure is an abusive... And but then other lawyers spoke out and said, look, I don't care what goes on the 6 o'clock news. I don't care if it hurts the property values in the association. I don't care about any of that. I'm going to maximize my client's recovery. I'm going to go after the foreclosure. I don't care. It doesn't make any difference to me. Bad press, none of that matters.
And I'm going
to
buy myself.
It's shocking to listen to, really.
And I'm going to buy myself a new Beamer with the proceeds. We're talking.
Precisely.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's where this all leads. But I heard it from a very well-known attorney's mouth. I heard him speaking out about this issue, and other people in the audience were just shaking their heads saying, oh, my goodness, this is terrible.
Yeah, we're going to
there really are, contrary to popular opinion, there actually are two schools of thought within community association lawyers, specialists, among them, I should say, on how to behave. Some of them want to be more like counselors, and others want to be radical advocates, and they're not of one mind.
Well, I'm hoping that those who do not approve of foreclosure, you said non-judicial, I just don't think foreclosure should be allowed, but I would
wait a minute, Sue. If we don't have foreclosure at all, any form of foreclosure, then how are associations supposed to... stay solvent.
We're going to take a break and we'll come back and we'll talk about that. Right, Evan? Don't go away. We'll be right back.
Well, I finally bought my dream home to enjoy retirement life. I've made new friends and buddies, lots of parties for my wife. It seemed that life was perfect, all my neighbors felt the same. Then along came death by CCRs, life's over, I'm fair game.
those petty rules and regulations, it's enough to make you cry. They're full of woes, no pink flamingos, someone tell us why. Slick managers and lawyers slither close, but they won't tell why our dream home should remind us we bought a one-way ticket to hell.
WEBR, Fairfax Radio, you're on the Commons. I'm Sue Bartholomew, and on the Commons with us today is Professor Evan McKenzie. Thank you so much, Evan, for being with us. And we've been having a really heated discussion about the new rights and responsibilities, and we were talking a little bit off the air here about it, and you wanted to go into it a little more?
Oh, yeah, one more point on this sort of how do you make it real kind of thing. First, I think the critical thing is you've got to get the professionals to sign on because they're the ones who advise the boards. And if you could get the professionals, particularly the lawyers, to say this is the way to do things, then and get them to, in essence, agree to that, then you know that would have some impact. Secondly, if you've got principles, even if they're not enforceable, principles take on a life of their own sometimes. And that is, when an organization aspires to certain principles, often they don't mean it. This happens all the time. But over time, people keep pointing out, wait a minute, you agreed to this, you said this. And it does have persuasive effect. And it could have effect in association elections, campaigns, and things of this sort, that people are not living up to the standards that the association subscribed to. In other words, you could run for office against the board saying, well, it says here in Rights and Responsibilities that foreclosure is supposed to be a last resort, which it does say. And if they're not using it as a last resort, that would be grounds for saying that they've gone contrary to their own principles. So you see, from a persuasive standpoint, this could be quite significant, but I believe it'll never have much effect unless you get the lawyers to sign on to it.
How would you envision that working? Would an association that is looking to hire an attorney look for one who's signed on to Rights and Responsibilities?
Yes, and number one, I think personally that CAI, you know, CAI is the organization you really need to belong to in order to learn about this. And if CAI took a very hard line on this and said, look, one of the things you're agreeing to when you join CAI is Rights and Responsibilities. I'm just speculating now. And they said, this is our official philosophy. This is our code of ethics. It's like the Hippocratic Oath for the mm-hmm. medical profession. This is our Hippocratic Oath here. And if you want to be a member of this organization, you have to agree to this. If they did that, sure, some people would flaunt it, but on the whole, it would have persuasive impact. If they went further and embodied this in a code of, or I should say, standards of professional responsibility for their trade association, then it becomes the standard of practice, potentially, in the industry. Then if you had malpractice suits and other things, I don't know, I'm just speculating again, but these are persuasive type documents that can be used to argue, you know what, there really is a standard of conduct. And a given lawyer or property manager does have a standard they should live up to. Right now, everything is so vague that you have to call in people like me as expert witnesses to try to argue about what the standard of care is, and then you have disagreement. And I think writing this stuff down could have a persuasive impact, just like building standards on how to install a window flashing and so forth. Those industry standards have an impact on conduct. No, they aren't perfect. You still have people installing window flashings wrong.
Yeah.
But the fact that there is a standard shows there's something people can be held to.
Okay, now I feel a little more comfortable with that when you sort of add on the professionals as well. And if you have that as a condition of belonging to CAI, right now it just seems like, oh, well, you know, what we're doing here is trying to deflect some of the bad publicity. So we have this paper, and here are your rights, and here are your responsibilities, and if you say you'll agree to abide by them, we'll give you a certificate, and off you go. It just didn't seem like it really had any weight.
Well, you know, the document has been written, and now the question is what CAI is going to do with it and exactly how it is going to be used, and that is not clear yet.
Okay.
I mean, the ideas that I've been throwing out are just my ideas.
I like them, though. I really like them.
And then the next step is, you know, to see what the organization will do with them and what they can get their membership to go along with. I can tell you, you know, that the people who are advocating for this document within CAI have taken substantial heat from some of the people who I consider the more rapacious practitioners, put it that way. They don't like seeing foreclosure being a last resort, for example. They don't like that one bit. And, I mean, the good lawyers, in my opinion, the good lawyers do like it. The sharp practitioners do not like it. See, they don't want any limits on anything.
I would like to see some of these good lawyers come and help us lobby for some of these laws, because I'll tell you...
Well, actually, but isn't it the case that hasn't the Executive Council of Homeowners in California gone on record? Maybe I'm wrong about this, but this is what I was told, that they've actually gone on record supporting elimination of nonjudicial foreclosure. Had you heard this?
You know, I think... I may have heard it.
I can tell you this. I heard attorneys at this conference, a number of them, saying they would never do nonjudicial foreclosure. Would never do that.
Well, you know, even some of the judicial foreclosures that come really close to nonjudicial, because I know that some of them will just go to court and there'll be a clerk outside just stamping the papers that are put in front of them.
But procedures vary from state to state.
Yeah, with no review.
Along with that. But here's the thing. The problem with nonjudicial foreclosure, in part, is that people are sitting around waiting for a court hearing that never happens. Because I think most people expect that there must be a court hearing involved in losing your home. At the very least, you know, you get a day in court. You don't have to, with judicial foreclosure, you don't have to file your own action, an action to quiet title. And the other thing here is, you know, this is such a streamlined procedure, like in California, it's such a streamlined procedure that it's way too fast, and in particularly when you see people, white-collar people losing their jobs and so forth, as has been happening in recent years, this is a very hard situation for a lot of people if they find themselves in. They've got to pay a bank, they've got to pay property taxes, they've got all these other expenses, and they've got their association assessments, and... I think there needs to be some court procedures and state laws and association practices that take note of this. On the other hand, I believe foreclosure has to be available as a last resort. It has to be, because otherwise you're going to have everyone else in the association paying for the assessments of people who aren't paying, and that is not fair. I mean, it is not fair if you've got 100 people in an association and 10 of them aren't paying that the other 90 have to pay their assessments for them ad infinitum, you know, for the next 20 years because they can't be foreclosed on.
I absolutely agree with you. I think that if you live in an association, you owe the money, no ifs, ands, or buts about it. But what we're seeing, Evan, is people are not being foreclosed on for the assessments that they owe, but actually money is... homeowners are trying to pay off and pay their debts, and the association or their collectors are refusing to accept the payments.
Right.
Winona is a prime example. She dropped off. She got a bill for $814.50, and she took a check to the association. They refused to accept it.
Well, you see, I know this stuff's happening, and if you look at the terms of rights and responsibilities, you will see that it is very clear that they're opposing that sort of thing.
Well, they're saying use it as a last resort. I'd like to see something that says any money that's being put in, given to the association, has got to be accepted because...
Well, listen to this, okay? Homeowners have the right to, and this is from Rights and Responsibilities, fair treatment regarding financial and other association obligations, including the opportunity to discuss payment plans and options with the association before foreclosure is initiated. Now, I heard lawyers saying that they always do this, that they do not want to foreclose, that their associations that they represent do not want to foreclose. Then I hear these other lawyers saying, oh, you know, we start foreclosure proceedings right away, you see? And what the idea of this document is to get everybody to agree that foreclosure should be a last resort, that people should be able to work out payment plans, and all these businesses of this refusing payment because it's $1.50 less than it's supposed to be, and all that other nonsense goes out the window.
Yeah, I mean, that's the one out, and if anybody's sitting there thinking $1.50 is wrong, no, you heard right. There was
That's exactly what happened, and in that case, Molly Foley Healy discussed that case at length and put it up in her PowerPoint presentation and about what a terrible thing it was. So, you know, I'm telling you, you've got actually some people in the organization that are receptive to these ideas and ideas for reform, but they've got to sell it to their organization. And then the further problem is, of course, you've got to get it to filter down to the local chapters, because my personal opinion is the National CAI organization has been aware of this need for reform for some time, and the Community First book and other things, that all came from CAI National. But there are these people out in the local chapters, and some of them are just sort of, you know...
I know.
They're not, they don't care what's
I know.
Going on. They don't care about the big picture. They care about the little picture.
And I'll tell you something else, Evan, because I've run into this, but some of these guys, some of these attorneys who represent associations actually really thoroughly enjoy all the bad publicity because it's the only way they'll ever see their name in print. It doesn't matter, even if it's bad. You know, they're going to get their name up in print. And so they'll continue with this.
Charming. Charming, absolutely charming.
Their response is, hey, it's good publicity. You know, nobody's going to remember what they heard my name in connection with. They're just
right.
going to remember that they heard my name.
Right, but you see, Shu, look, the problem is, you know, the legal profession, who can stop this? This is the question.
I know,
who
you
can
can't.
Stop
I know, you can't. No.
Because the state bar associations can't do anything about it, apparently. They don't seem to be able to stop it. And I'm not just talking about community association lawyers. I'm talking about divorce lawyers or any kind of lawyers. Where's the meaningful regulation of lawyers generally? And you'll find that even state bar associations can't do it very effectively.
Yeah, they can't.
And so there need to be, I think this idea of specialized standards of conduct that apply to this type of lawyer, the however many hundred of lawyers are really good at this, and some way of getting them to subscribe to these principles is probably the best we can do. But if this doesn't work, everyone understands this. If they can't rein these people in and get them to behave intelligently, then you're talking about state legislation. And I said at the meeting, I'll say here again, I am convinced that some of these people, there are some lawyers, like the people I listen to, saying I don't care, I don't care if I'm on the news, I don't care if the association's property values go down. That type of person, unfortunately, can only be stopped by legislation. You have to make illegal the things they're doing. I don't see any way around it for some of these people.
You know,
they're just unbelievable.
When we started talking about rights and responsibilities a moment ago, you started off by saying that you, at the CAI Law Seminar, you said it was a document that was being written by CAI and to the homeowners. Shouldn't the homeowners be involved in maybe working with some of this or the housing consumers? I know that there are a lot of them that maybe shouldn't, would get too emotional, but should there be the people, should the people who ultimately have got to live in these things and make them work be involved in any way?
Well, the thing's already basically written as far as I know. I think that my understanding was that Molly ran this past a tremendous number of people before, in many drafts before they came to this one. I don't know to what extent owners were involved in it, but obviously, you know, I think they're a concerned party. There's no doubt about that. But you know what this really does, though? I mean, the document, it's never going to please. There's nothing CAI could do that's going to please all the owner activists. Nothing. Short of disbanding.
Well, one of the things that we're finding in this, I mean, quite apart from, you know, the minute you have an association in a neighborhood, you've got a polarized neighborhood. I think also within the people, the stakeholders, everybody's polarized. Everybody's sort of sitting in their own corner. As far as I know, on the Commons is the only forum that's open to everyone. I mean, I'll have members of the industry on, I'll have homeowners on, I'll have professionals on, I'll have legislators on. Everybody is welcome to come on if
that's
they have.
True. That's really terrific. That's why I like your show so much.
Shouldn't there be sort of more communication and interaction?
That's my opinion, but I think there should be, yes. I think there should be more communication. But you know what happens, Shu, and this is where I think, you know, the shoe has to go on the other foot here for a minute.
Okay.
You got a lot of people who have set themselves up as critics of this type of housing who, in my opinion, are just are not even making the slightest attempt to work with anybody in the industry. They won't do it. They won't even talk to them. And it's constant name-calling and personal abuse, vilification, calling people all kinds of slanderous names and, you know, putting pictures on the Internet with horns on their heads and all this nonsense. I mean, is this a way to reach out to try to to try to actually solve problems, or is this just grandstanding? Because I think there's a lot of that.
I think there's a
there's a lot of grandstanding going on, and I just a sort of self-righteous, destructive tone that is not, it just doesn't produce anything. It's just tilting at windmills. Ultimately, you're not going to get anywhere behaving like that. Yeah. No one's going to take you seriously after a relatively short time. It doesn't accomplish anything.
I think there's some people out there that you can sit down and talk to and have an intelligent conversation with, and some people, and it's been that way from the, you know, from years ago when I first got involved working here. I was one of the founding members of the now defunct Council for Homeowner Rights here in Virginia back in the 80s and early 90s. And even back then, I mean, people just saw things from their own perspective, and you know, they wouldn't open their eyes. They wouldn't look at it. They wouldn't realize that this was much, much bigger than they were. I mean, they thought that the problem ended at the tip of their noses. What they saw was it. You know,
right.
That was the problem.
Yes, that's right.
And I can understand not wanting to sit down with some of these people. I'll be perfectly honest. That's one of the reasons I work alone. But there, you know, there are some people who would be able to contribute, maybe present the other side of the issues, maybe point out some of the frustrations, maybe come up with something that might be workable.
Yeah. But, you know, look at it this way. Let's say, look at it like a two-party negotiation. Let's say you've got two people on one side, two people on the other. On each side, there's a reasonable person and an unreasonable person. The reasonable person wants to make a deal with the other side if possible. The unreasonable person is not interested in anything except continuing the conflict. That is, in fact, what's going on. In the industry, you have people who want peace and resolution and people who want to profit from the conflict. And the same thing is true among owner activists. There are some who want to solve problems, who want to find solutions, and, you know, who are interested in hearing all sides of the question, like yourself. And then there are other people who are enjoying the conflict for a variety of reasons, personal reasons. They like the conflict. Now, what happens is, unfortunately, when both parties sit down in front of a state legislature, 9 times out of 10, what happens is the people on the industry side who are not interested in solutions will tar all the owners with the same brush.
Yeah.
They will point to the people who are acting unreasonably and making outrageous accusations and say, see, look at the owner activists. See how disreputable they are?
Yeah. No, I realize that. I understand.
And that is really bad for the owner's position because they are much less numerous and much less powerful than the industry.
Yeah.
And sure, you can point to examples of abuse among the professionals, but ultimately you're talking about licensed professionals who know how to play the game. And on the whole, in the mudslinging battle, the professionals win. Time after time. That's the basic logic right there.
I tend to talk to a lot of the legislators, and what I hear from them is that they're seeing through it. Both the homeowners, who they consider wacky and don't get involved with, and they kind of stay away from them, and then you also have the members of the industry who are really abusive and hard, and that comes through as well.
Yeah.
So I think they're beginning to recognize that in both camps there are two kinds of people.
Yes, and I think, you know, what's really driving this is increasingly, I think, in the number of states like Florida, Arizona, California, Texas, and so forth, there's so much of this housing around that the legislators have had to educate themselves about it.
Yeah.
And they have come to the realization that there really are issues that need to be dealt with.
Yeah.
Something's got to be done. They can't just let this high level of conflict and financial issues and everything else continue forever. They've got to do something productive. One way or another, they've got to find some kind of solutions. And that leads them to try to say, all right, you know, we're going to find, hopefully, they'll find the reasonable people to work with on both sides of this and try to do something intelligent.
Yeah.
There's a lot of, as you know, there's a lot of legislation in Florida.
Oh, I know.
Right now, and a lot in Arizona. And some of it is really pretty dramatic stuff. So what will be left at the end of the legislative session, I don't know. But it's pretty dramatic stuff, and it shows that some legislators are beginning to see this as a policy area that needs some serious attention.
Julio Urbina was on. He's from Florida, and he is just a real dynamo. He said that he's going to spend the rest of his career making sure that these abuses go away in Florida.
So there you go.
So But Evan, would you believe we had 3 items that we were going to talk about today, and we didn't. We got to 2 of them. So you'll just have to come back.
Sure.
For the international conference and tell us all about that one.
I'd be happy to do that another time. No problem at all.
Great. Thank you so much. And thanks so much for joining us today, Evan. And to all of you, thanks for joining us on The Commons. Stay tuned. Stay free. On The Commons was produced by OTC Multimedia Productions. See you all next week.